This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're talking to members of the Northwest Indiana Legislative Delegation as the 2019 session is approaching the end about the bills they have introduced and some of the other issues as well that have come up this session. And now we're talking with Representative Lisa Beck. She's a Democrat who represents portions of Lake and Porter counties. And Lisa, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's get going here on, I guess, the one question I suppose that maybe you'd get asked, or if not, it probably will come up eventually. How has your very first General Assembly session gone so far?
I think it's been a really positive experience. I think that there was a fear that maybe, you know, we wouldn't be able to get anything done, and I think that that's not the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of bills that we've had that have been voted on unanimously. There's a lot of good work that's happened down here, and I'm really, really happy about that.
Well, let's talk about some of the bills, the ones you've sponsored in particular. The one that comes to mind first here is one that affects us here in Lake County in particular and will also affect St. Joseph County. It's House Bill 1451. It's a measure that that you introduced this session that would help public libraries in Lake and in St. Joseph counties to help recover some of the revenue that they're going to lose here when the circuit breaker kicks in here at the end of this year going into 2020. Tell us a little bit more about that measure and how it seems to be faring so far in the session.
Well, as you're aware, I was sworn in on November 20th of last year, and we had until December 10th to get our bills together before the session started.
Mm-hmm.
So in that short period of time, I knew that there was an issue with the circuit breaker because I had talked to Lake County Council, Lake County Commissioners, my local mayors, and other elected officials who have had concerns and have had talked to quite a few folks who didn't even realize that they were just in passing talking to me about this issue. So it's going to affect a lot of people, the circuit breaker. I'm talking about fire departments. I've talked to people that are parts of the streets department. And so it's a huge issue. So our first attempt was to look at ways to get or to help our libraries, because the libraries will be affected. Of course, I'm more concerned with, and I've only spoken to libraries in Crown Point and Hobart mm-hmm. and Winfield. So that bill did not get a hearing. However, I have had conversations with Representative Todd Houston, who is basically in charge of the budget, and he is very well aware of the issue. In fact, in October of last year, before I was elected, there was a meeting that was held, a study session that was held in Hammond. And that meeting discussed, there were local officials that basically gave their point of view on what the change needs to be. I think that if I could have what I wanted, we would have an extension of another 10 years. Unfortunately, there are opponents on the other side who would argue that the Constitution would prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still working on trying, we haven't given up. We're still working on trying to find a solution so that Lake County's not devastated by when the caps are taken off. So I did take the 4 hours to watch the hearing that is online. You can actually, it was recorded. The argument from Lake County and St. Joe County was that, at least for the Lake County, there are several arguments why we did, in fact, need the relief from the caps.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those arguments, and I think there we have quite a few legitimate arguments why Lake County and St. Joe County needed the relief, was, and I just want to say that this relief is for school debt, that school debt that was prior to 2008. So I think, I know in my community, in District 19, we care a lot about our schools. And I think most residents, you know, we've gotten our referendums passed. I know there are folks that moved into Crown Point and Hobart because of the school systems. So, you know, and I can't attest to all of Lake County, but I'm sure that other communities feel the same way. But because we're so close to Chicago, we have issues that were unique to Lake County. And that's why we got the relief 10 years ago. So there was a reason why Lake County is distinct and different from the other counties and why we needed the relief.
One of the other measures that, have you've been reviewing here and that you're a co-sponsor on is House Bill 1520. It talks about child support. Give us a little summary about that and how it is doing as well in the session right now.
Well, that was a bill, I believe, that I co-authored with the leader, and it had to do with child support after the age of 18. And I do think that that's an important bill. I think the majority of the work that I'm doing down here, however, has been as ranking member and ranking minority member in the labor and pensions group. I'm also in the Commerce, Small Business, and Economic Development, which, quite frankly, has been a little disappointing because I'm not the ranking member in that group, in that committee. However, we've only seen two bills, and we've had two meetings. That's it. I think in Lake County, especially in House District 19, I would have really liked to have seen some work in those committees. I also was in Courts and Criminal Code. We did some good work in those committees. The majority of the time that I've spent here has really been in those committees, working on the bills that we've been that we've had come through. Some of the good work that we did in labor and pensions, there was a bill that was passed that allowed for workers' comp when a fireman is a volunteer fireman leaves his job to go work for the fire department, that individual will be covered by workers' comp underneath the fire department instead of the employer. Something else that was really important, we had a worker comp bill that provided that we increased the penalties, the OSHA penalties, when there's a death on the work on the workplace. And that bill came out of the death of a young woman, 23-year-old woman in Fort Wayne, who was killed when she stepped inside a machine that she never should have ever stepped inside of. The machine was set up so that it was basically a killing machine. They had taken the safeguards. The company had taken the safeguards off the machine, taken the floor of the machine out, and she had to step inside of it in order to operate it.
Oh, my goodness.
She had never been trained on the machine. So the bill that we passed provided that instead of a $70,000 penalty, that an employer in that situation would now be assessed with a $130,000 penalty. Most employers, most factories are responsible, and we don't have these safety concerns. But in this case, it was just way over the top what had happened to this poor woman, the family. And we had testimony from the family. So that was that I feel like was a really good bill that we had passed.
One of the other measures, it's actually a Senate bill. Senate Bill 83 is Senator Eddie Melton and Senator Ed Charbonneau authored it in their chamber, and you've supported it in the House. It is more of, I guess it's written, I guess, in a way that seems to be close to central Indiana, but it's about tax increment financing. But you must feel that there's some very serious concerns that would affect Northwest Indiana, and why you've decided that you want to sign on to this one. Tell us a little bit about that measure and where it stands right now.
Yeah, that's the tax increment financing. TIF is what most people know that as.
Yeah.
What that bill is about, it will allow a taxing unit, city or town, to use 15% of the TIF money for maintenance. So what that looks like is, let's say that a city puts in, you know, the really nice paver sidewalk. If that sidewalk later has to be redone or a portion has to be replaced, they have to go back to their general budget currently. So what the bill would allow the city or town to use TIF money, the same money that puts the sidewalk in, to also maintain it, and only 15%. I will tell you that we've had meetings on this, and it doesn't look like it's going to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
The argument opposing that bill, Senate Bill 83, is that the money should only be for advancing or for new projects.
Well, it seems interesting that they should have that opposition to it, because these improvements that you talk about in the measure and that everybody seems to support would in turn help improve and add to the enhancement of economic development in that particular area. But yeah, that we'll just have to, I guess, wait and see about that. Let me ask.
Yeah,
you,
we had good support. Northwest Indiana Forum came out and supported it as well. So we'll wait and see. We still have a week and a half left.
Well, as we stand right now, as we're down near the last days of the session, what do you think will be, at least in your estimation, and when talking with your colleagues in the House about the budget, what do you think the things will stand as far as the 2-year state budget is concerned?
I think that the biggest concern on the budget right now is, are we going to adequately fund public education?
Mm-hmm.
Not only do we need to make sure that we have to give public education more than just less than the cost of living. And that's what we've been doing for the last 10 years. $300 million, when we keep talking about this, was taken from the budget 10 years ago, and it's never been replaced. Our school systems, and we have some of the best school systems in the state, in my district, are hurting. And the other concern is teacher raises. You know, we keep playing a shell game down here with giving them their raises. I think that we need to see real money come into the school districts. One of my concerns, being on the labor and pension committee, is we tried to get a bill passed in the House. David Nagotsky, a Democrat from, I think he's from the South Bend region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He passed a bill as a misclassification bill that really is talking about payroll fraud. And he wanted to have a study done on payroll fraud, which is a huge issue, especially in Northwest Indiana and some of the more, you know, the areas of the state that have more working families, more concentration of workers. And, you know, it's a really important measure because it wasn't that long ago that we had a newspaper article up in Northwest Indiana that had found an employer that was, defrauding, not paying payroll taxes, not paying the state and local tax, unemployment tax, worker comp, which we know really affects the rest of the state, every other taxpayer that is paying. And that bill did not get a hearing on the House side. And I was really disappointed about that because I think that would have been really important to have that study done. I think, and I've talked with some of our locals, I think that we don't necessarily need the study session. It would have been nice to have it, but we're going to go ahead and go forward anyway. And I've talked with some of the local prosecutor's offices about how we can fix this problem because it really is a drain on the state, and it's not fair to taxpayers it's not fair to the companies that are paying taxes correctly, that are paying employees correctly, and it's not fair to taxpayers. We're going to do a trade fair sometime in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to partner with the building and trades, and we're going to work with them to get the message out about trades and how important they are. One of the things that I heard knocking doors was when individuals are displaced from a profession. They've lost their job and they don't know where to turn. They didn't know where to go. And in fact, we had a question on our survey that went out to everyone in House District 19.
Mm-hmm.
I asked, were they aware of the training that was available? And only 34% said yes. So we are going to work really hard to make sure that people know about the training that's available locally. And of course, we're lucky up in Northwest Indiana. We have a lot of the trade unions who offer the best training for their members.
Well, Lisa, thank you for spending some time with us to talk about these issues that you've sponsored and supported in the General Assembly as we're getting towards the end of the 2019 session. And thank you for spending time with us to talk about these issues. Hope to have a chance to talk with you here after the session ends, and we'll do a little post-mortem about how things turned out after all. I guess we'll just have to wait and see on some of the issues and at least some chances to get measures in place for the next session coming up. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Lisa Becca is a Democrat representative. She represents portions of Lake and Porter counties. Another Pops concert is coming up next month for the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, and it is one that musical director and conductor Kirk Muspratt is calling just out of this world, and we asked him why. Sounds like a great concert coming up here. What's the incentive for entitling it One Small Step?
As we all know, Chris, this year celebrates the 50th anniversary of the astonishing physicists and scientists and astronauts, pilots, all those people who landed on the moon, the Americans who landed on the moon 50 years ago, One Small Step. There's a program out that is available to orchestras recently that where we, on the second half of the concert, we play the music of Copeland, Appalachian Spring, for instance, and while that music is going on, there's a movie provided to us about all the engineering and testing and launching and inside the cabin and then on the moon while the music is playing. So you're watching a video of that while we're playing Copeland on the second half.
That's great.
It's, absolutely fascinating.
We're talking about space travel and space flight.
Yeah.
Be a lot of other things space-related. In fact, almost everything is going to be space-related, except those for most of the music from Aaron Copland. Tell us here about the rest of the program for the evening.
You're exactly on the money, Chris. So we're going to play music that has to do with either the moon or outer space, and it'll be very fun. It is a Pops concert, and it's great for kids, too, if they want to come with their family. So we'll do things like Zarathustra, the main title from Star Wars, Duel of the Fates, Apollo 13, Star Trek, Adventures from E.T., those kinds of very beautiful, enjoyable things. But then I also wanted to mention, Chris, that after intermission, before we start the second half, Jerry Ross, Colonel Jerry Ross, who was born in Crown Point and is one of the astonishing astronauts from the program, is going to come and give a presentation on stage for about 7 minutes of photographs and slides of him working as a flight engineer and developing programs and what he did on the space shuttle and the International Space Station, and also his spacewalks, because he has done more spacewalks, well, maybe not, no, maybe he's the second most in the world for spacewalks in the whole world for just being outside. And he's also holds the record for the most launches of any astronaut. So he's going to be there and present another whole area of entertainment and joy and information to us, being a local hero.
Well, you could definitely say, too, that as far as Jerry Ross is concerned, he is the only author who has actually taken so many spacewalks, being on the shuttle, because he's written a number of books have been related to his time in space and the space station, to what it's like to be out there walking around in space. He's a very interesting fellow to talk to.
Yes, a wonderful man, too.
It sounds like a great program coming up, entitled One Small Step, Another Pops Concert for the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra on May 17th.
It's at Monbeck Auditorium at the high school in Highland.
Good place to listen to music, a beautiful venue. Highland High School has plenty of great seats for people to listen to the concert and take part in the program, enjoying the comments from Jerry Ross. And now, if anybody's interested in getting tickets for the event, how can they do so?
Yeah, just call the symphony office, you know, right there at the CVPA in Munster, and we look forward to it. Or you can also buy them online if you want.
Well, Kirk, thanks very much for spending a little time with us to talk about this great concert coming up on May 17th. One Small Step, a space-related concert with a little Aaron Copland thrown in for good measure. And it's going to happen at Monbeck Auditorium at the Highland High School in Highland, Indiana. And thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you.
The championship of one of the longest-running amateur boxing tournaments in the nation kicked off last week. More than 70 boxers, men and women, were competing in the 96th annual Chicago Golden Gloves tournament in Cicero. And Michael Putty had a chance to meet with some of the young fighters before the tournament got underway. And one young athlete he talks about isn't letting a physical limitation get in the way of his dreams of going pro.
They're not here for the big payouts or endorsement deals. These boxers are here to compete for the right to be called a Golden Gloves champion.
Oh man, it started out as just like a place for me to work out it. And I wanted to challenge myself and see if I can do it in the ring.
That's Michelle Trevina, who's an emergency room nurse at the University of Illinois Hospital in Chicago by day, but she boxes at night. She's been training for about a year and made her tournament debut 2 weeks ago at the start of the Golden Gloves tournament.
It is my very first fight ever. Very nervous for sure.
Trevina won that match and will compete in the championship round this weekend at the intimate Cicero Stadium. Some here do have dreams of moving on to boxing fame, just like greats such as Muhammad Ali, Joe Louis, and Sonny Liston did while competing in this very tournament decades ago.
Since I was 14, I told myself, yeah, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
That's 23-year-old Caleb Hernandez of Crown Point, Indiana, who trains at the Hammond Boxing Club. Hernandez won his weight class the last 2 years, but he'd like another win.
Trying to go for 3 years in a row here. If I win the finals, I go to Nationals, National Golden Gloves after that, pro.
On this first night of the tournament last month, there were some 25 three-round bouts, The stands were packed with onlookers eating snacks as the boxers duked it out. The athletes warm up in the wings of the stadium until their number is called. A young boxer, Kyron Brown, sits quietly in the stands waiting for his bout. Number 22 is finally called late in the evening.
All right, boxers, for bout 22 to the ring, please. Bout 22.
At 19 years old, Brown's been boxing since he was 9. His first unofficial fights happened on the streets of Chicago's West Garfield Park neighborhood.
As a little boy, I was always confident. I lived in a rough neighborhood, and all we did is fight. So I didn't see the difference between the streets and the boxing ring. You know, if anything, I learned a lot from it.
Brown actually stopped boxing the last couple of years to concentrate on graduating high school and becoming a freshman at Malcolm X College. He returned to the ring a few months ago ahead of the Golden Gloves tournament. One of his trainers, Danielle Ruiz, thinks Brown has tremendous talent with only one potential weakness, his eyesight. Blind in his right eye since birth, Ruiz says Brown doesn't allow it to define him.
Some fighters have slow reflexes, some fighters don't have power, but I don't see it as a huge disadvantage. Actually, I think it developed a style the way he fights now, because you see he's real fluid.
His other trainer, Carlos Castaneda, owner of Oakley Fight Club in Chicago, says safety is always first and wouldn't let Brown compete if he couldn't do it.
I think he has a sixth sense now with that eyesight out. He does things that are very untraditional with boxers, and I think his handicapping has nothing to do with it. When I talk to him, I don't see him as a blind person. I see him as a special person.
Despite the risk, Brown isn't concerned about injuring his left good eye.
My family's always concerned about me and my health being. But I'm not worried. My vision in my left eye is completely strong. I'm getting checked out. It's something that I can do. I'm confident in.
Brown came up big in his semifinal match 2 weeks ago, winning a close bout.
And in this 152-pound elite division, our winner tonight by split decision, out of the blue corner,
tonight, he will compete for the Golden Gloves Championship in the 152-pound elite division against a fighter who won this weight class last year. Brown just keeps reminding himself of his ultimate goal.
I got my eye on the prize.
The championship rounds begin tonight and goes to Saturday. I'm Michael Puente.
And we should mention that Michael had his conversation with the boxers late last week and the report that he brought to us on Friday. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. At the State House, Senate Republicans released their budget proposal with more money for schools over the next 2 years. Gaming legislation went through some major changes, and an expansion of the state's Stand Your Ground law is headed back into the House. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman tells us more about this past week that ended at the State House.
The Senate GOP budget proposal would send $535 million more dollars to schools over the next 2 years, a $74 million increase compared to the House proposal. But the Senate plan would also cut the amount of money that goes to virtual schools, from 90% of tuition support per student to 80%. The House Ways and Means Committee made major changes to the session's gaming bill. It severed ties between a Gary casino and a potential new casino in Terre Haute. Vigo County voters can decide on a new license with a ballot referendum, regardless of what happens in Gary. The other change in committee cut the Gary casino's cost of moving by $50 million. That, along with reports of the governor taking two private flights with the Gary casino CEO, sparked an amendment in the House, codifying better transparency when lawmakers meet with casino representatives. And the Senate passed an expansion of the state's Stand Your Ground law. The expansion extends the criminal protection of the use of force to defend yourself, your property, or someone else to civil court. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
The managing director of operations for the new Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan is a seasoned veteran of the data industry. We had a chance to talk recently with David Hood about the experience that he's bringing to the position in Hammond, as well as more about this massive project along Lake Michigan. For folks that are not familiar, Mr. Hood, with your work, know that you've spent a lot of time working in telecommunications and in data center management, but in your most recent jobs have been in Chicago. What does a data center manager really do?
Well, at the most basic level, we keep all the blinking lights green. Uh-huh. We mitigate any errors, any potential threats to data transmissions, and compute power, and a home user, say, we make sure that their connection to either Netflix, YouTube, whatever they're connecting to is maintained so that it doesn't go down and they have any outages.
Now, a lot of your work, I know, has been working with the telecommunications infrastructure, which certainly fits this very well. Interested you, number one, in what this job potential might be compared to what you were doing over in Chicago?
Well, considering this whole project, the ability to maintain people's connectivity, but do it in a more environmentally friendly manner, is certainly a big draw. The facility we have here has the potential to utilize a lot more green power than a lot of data centers in the area. Frankly, mm-hmm. there's just an easier, more flexible environment in which we can create and additionally maintain green power and do it economically as well. Just the ability to work with the state of Indiana has been great as well. But the real key, besides all the help the legislation's given us, is the green power piece and being able to do that in the right way this time.
When you talk about being able to take a project like what you've worked on in the past in Chicago and other places and basically follow along, I guess, to a point in the same sort of operation that's being proposed here along Lake Michigan, but with this new component, the green energy part of it, is that the newest and the most exciting part of what you're going to be doing?
That is correct. I would say everybody wants to have the data centers up and running, but it takes a lot of energy to do that, and it can take energy from coal plants just to get it done. We're trying to avoid that as much as possible, and like I said, just the ability to utilize wind, the solar aspect of being able to provide power for this, and our managing members' design theory behind consolidating all these power sources, renewable and traditional power, is just very exciting and kind of a neater project to work on than just a normal data center. Mm-hmm. It's almost as exciting as building a data center, say, in Iceland, where every power is really cheap and the cooling is free.
And of course, in a way here too, you've got the advantage of being right next to this big lake, which will cool things very nicely too, right?
Very nicely, yes.
When you had a chance to sit down and talk with Peter Feldman and with Tom Dokich of Digital Crossroads, and I guess in some of your discussions you had, what did they say that seemed to interest you the most about this project?
The availability of the water, and then just space to do the green power. And that's a good question. Pete, for a great many years, and they've always had various projects that involve the green power aspect. So it's been an ongoing discussion, and gratefully they've involved me in some of those discussions over the years. So, the minute this was brought up, it was just a renewal of an ongoing discussion that was just as exciting as it was, maybe 10 years ago when we first started working together.
Mm-hmm. So he's followed through in a lot of his projects and other cases, perhaps, that with the green concept, and this is just the latest generation of that?
That is correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always been one of the top pieces on his agenda to get a data center as green as possible.
Any contact with what this tech incubator is going to be doing?
We haven't had much time to discuss that quite yet due to the nature of getting a building and a project started, but we're looking forward to those discussions.
What can you tell us on the latest on the construction that is underway for the building along the lake right now?
Maybe just foundation going now. The rest of the actual construction of the building is about to become officially, I guess it's officially underway, but things just ramp up, and we're really gathering some steam now. And once that is, say, fully rolling, and then we have walls up, we'll be able to start paying a little more attention to some of these other things, like the tech incubator.
You're obviously going to have most of your space dedicated to the data center itself and all of the specialized equipment that it has to go in there. And then, of course, you've got, I guess, a very, very special, very, very green HVAC system, I guess, to put in there too, don't you?
It just takes a lot of airflow, and we're gonna have a lot of airflow to accommodate that between that and the lake water, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is also planned on the outside on the property there? You'll have a lot of extra room to work with, and you have a lot of space, luckily, that you'll have to be able to plan for the future and any future expansion. What else, at least in this first phase of the data center project, are you hoping to take advantage of along Lake Michigan?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Have spent a lot of time on the building itself, I guess, and this is some nice things you can kind of sketch out in your mind and on paper and look to the future for.
There's just so much possibility here that even like the tech incubator, we are looking forward to the next 6 months when we can start looking towards the future and get past the initial first phase, building and getting that off the kind of off the drawing board and out onto the field. There's quite a few things that, just you potentially wind power, what we talked about, the solar aspect, the amount of late cooling, all those things. And just for phase two, how to more efficiently utilize these aspects and not just the phase one stuff, but really fine tuning it to make it work right and make it work better than, say any other data center around. So there's a great deal of opportunity here. It's just going to take us a little bit of time to get through all the possibilities and, fine-tune what we really want to do with the potential here.
We're talking with David Hood. He is the new Managing Director of Operations for the brand-new Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan, the data center that is currently under construction along Lake Michigan in what used to be the footprint of the old state line generating plant that used to produce electricity, and now will take advantage of the best in the green energy to create electricity and keep the lights on and the equipment running. I know that you're probably working more closely with Peter Feldman and maybe with Tom Dockich about initial employment plans or how many folks you want to have once the facility is built and up and running.
Yeah, ultimately we're going to have around 40 to potentially 50 people employed in the building directly in various aspects of managing the site. Just having a data center is going to expand. Our tenants are going to have employees as well.
Right.
So it's a little bit than just looking at our direct employment, our W-2 guys. Depending on the people we have moving in, and we're looking at hyperscale clients in the data center industry, which are the bigger guys, they're going to have probably a dozen per client, technicians and other support staff in the facility working through them as well, and they're all looking to hire local talent, and we'll be helpful and we do what we can to help develop that local talent as well.
You've worked in the past primarily on such topics as rural broadband around Indiana and the like. Do you think that with this data center up and running, obviously it's going to take care of Northwest Indiana business and industry for the needs that they may have? Do you think that this may be a good link to be able to expand broadband service not only around our particular area but the rest of Indiana?
Absolutely. We're looking to create a hub for a lot of the broadband, expand everything to accommodate the 5G capabilities, the Internet of Things of the future. So, we're looking at ways to consolidate all the area fiber optic assets into the facility to make sure that we're prepared for the future and what comes beyond the next wave of cellular technology.
Well, it certainly sounds like that with this computing data center that you're helping supervise the construction of there in Hammond, the prospect of more business in Northwest Indiana, it'll be part of all that too within the tech incubator and a lot of other things that are going to be related there on the site. It's just nothing but looking up, I suppose, right now.
Absolutely. It's a very exciting project. I'm happy to be here. We've got a great team of people. The support from the local government all the way up to Indianapolis has been fantastic. So many positives here that it's almost hard to count.
Well, Mr. Hood, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about yourself and about the business, and in particular what you're going to be managing and the operations there at the Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan as the facility gets up and running here in the months and the years ahead. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time as well.
Looking on the medical scene, some doctors see access to birth control as a way to decrease maternal and infant mortality, but a history of abuse has led to distrust of medical professionals in communities of color. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis had a chance to talk recently with Dr. Bronson Tucker Edmonds at the IU School of Medicine about systemic racism, reproductive health, and how contraception seems to fit into these issues.
What is long-acting reversible contraception, and why are doctors pushing to discuss using LARC with their patients, particularly right after giving birth?
There are a couple of different sort of types of long-acting reversible contraception, but basically two large categories. One are intrauterine devices, or IUDs as commonly referred to, and those are devices that are inserted into a woman's uterus, and they can reside there for we'll say 5 years to 10 years. Some of them contain progesterone, some of them are copper, sort of different varieties of those, but those are intrauterine devices. And then the other category of long-acting reversible contraception, which I will call LARC from here on out because it's a mouthful, are the subdermal implants. We know that women who have pregnancies too close together are at increased risk for complications in those next pregnancies, for lower birth weights, for preterm delivery. So being able to space pregnancies out is a really important part of prenatal care, actually, of pregnancy and maternal child sort of care.
So LARC is a good option for many women, but it comes with heavy baggage for women of color. Why is that?
The Black community in particular, and communities of color, have wondered sometimes whether or not family planning programs were really intended to, you know, control women of color in terms of their bodies, their reproduction, whether they were, there's been, you know, people have pointed to or had concerns and conspiracies with regard to genocide and, you know, different types of ways to really try to keep Black women from reproducing. And so that's sort of a long history and sort of culturally embedded set of concerns that I think just based on a history of mistreatment within sort of the healthcare community and otherwise that we sort of wrestle with as a community.
What's it like for you as an OBGYN and a woman of color to provide care for these patients?
So I think, though, that it does help because I do sort of have that double consciousness. Like, I'm aware of the ways that women of color have been treated historically and still today in our healthcare system. And I have sort of this perspective and this medical training that helps me to understand that that can be true, and it can also be true that there are sort of medical, you know, technologies and treatments that can be of service to us as a community.
What is reproductive justice, and how can it play a role in healthcare?
It was largely a movement that grew out of sort of Black women's response, in large part to sort of what had begun as sort of a white middle class feminist movement that seemed to not really speak to the full experience of more marginalized populations. Reproductive justice was really trying to attend to that and saying that women should be able to choose if they want to parent. They should be able to choose when they want to parent, but they should also be able to parent under circumstances that really were both safe and supportive of them being able to raise their children to reach their full potential.
That was Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis talking with Dr. Bronson Tucker Edmonds of the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman was on Regionally Speaking not long ago with some of the latest information that you can find in the IYI's Kids Count Data Book for 2018.
For 25 years, we've been pulling together information with the idea that for us to be able to really help kids, we need to have some current accurate data on how they're faring. And so we pull together information from a lot of the different state agencies. So the Department of Education, the Department of Children's Services, the Department of Corrections, you know, all of those things, public health, as well as many other sources that have been vetted and, you know, are tested for reliability and all those kinds of things. So we pull all that together, and then we really go through and put it in, hopefully, an order that folks find usable. So it's broken down into four categories: family and community, economic well-being, education, and health. And it looks at those areas across the state of Indiana.
I know that a lot of this work is really just putting data together, but I would imagine, as you just mentioned here, that there are a lot of various places where it is available out there, and the average person is not going to be able to check out every single source and put things together. So this brings things together in one easy-to-understand piece, does it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when we started doing this 25 years ago, they said it wasn't that easy to get it. You know, you couldn't just hop on the computer and search data. And the reality is you can now, but just as you said, sometimes it's really hard to track down. It's really hard to know what's the most current resources, and it's really hard to get some of those different points together. So by pulling it all together, we're hoping, and we often hear great feedback, that people do find it a source that they can use for all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm.
Most commonly, you know, nonprofits use it to raise funds and to justify and get some of their grants. And then our policymakers, we were just at the State House a couple of days ago, and they said they use it a lot to inform new legislative policies or administrative policies.
I know a lot of people probably, especially new lawmakers, may or may not be familiar with some of the details of some of this, and they're focusing primarily on the bigger picture, and sometimes they probably need a little help in understanding these things.
They do. They do. And they're eager to get it. I will say we're spending several days this month at the State House doing what we're calling data and donuts and setting up between the two chambers and, you know, provide really those county snapshots. A lot of our elected leaders want to know not only the state information, but what exactly is happening in their area of the state that they represent. And then we can also do custom data requests. So, for example, if there's a senator or representative that is involved in a particular bill, say on education or on juvenile justice, we can drill down with them on that data to provide them the most current information so that they can take that into their committee hearings.
Okay, Tammy, let's go into a little more detail here, and we'll take a look at data from Lake and from Porter counties in particular here. We know that to be able to improve the well-being of children and youth in the state as well as in Northwest Indiana, you have to first understand the current reality. Let's talk about what the current reality seems to be on the topic of family and community.
Family and community, we know that one of the most critical issues here is the number of children who live with someone that has a problem with drugs or alcohol. And again, that takes into account the opioid crisis, and we've seen that impact on kids. The national average is 8.5%, and in Indiana, we're a little higher than that with 9.2%. So that equates to one out of every 11 children. And so again, this is something that we're looking at as well as in family and community. It looks at the number of children, the abuse rates for abuse and neglect. And unfortunately, in your area, that has gone up over the last 3 years from about 12% to right at about 20%.
Mm-hmm.
That is very consistent with the state average. So it has gone up, but it's not, you know, it's not any worse relative to the state.
On the issue of economic well-being, I know that there's very serious concern because there are many young people out there that are in families that are well below, in some cases, the economic threshold, and they're trying to deal with life as a young person, and on top of that, in a family that may not have enough money to be able to keep enough food on the table or a proper place to stay.
You're right. You're right. And as we many of us know, raising a child does take some financial resources and can be expensive. In many families, we know that the unemployment rates throughout the state have gone down significantly over the past 3 years. One of the things that we're digging into and looking at is to what extent do those jobs provide enough financial resources. So we have a lot of folks that are underemployed, right, or that maybe those jobs aren't providing a living wage. And so, again, in order to have the resources to provide for kids, we need to look at, are those jobs the most productive financially, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we know, again, in your area, the median household income has gone up over the last 3 years and is fairly consistent with the state average. The unemployment rates have gone down. And fortunately, it looks like there's a small decrease in the number of children living in poverty. So that, again, is going in the right direction. It is a little higher than the state average.
Now, how about housing costs? Because that's always part of it, too. If a family has to really scrape the money together to be able to feed a family and take care of the family, some of that comes into whether they can find a comfortable place to live.
Right. And comparatively, Indiana is a fairly inexpensive place to live.
Yeah.
And again, that varies greatly from community to community and area to area. But overall, we are placed 10th nationally for the lowest housing costs. So again, you know, relative to other states and living where you all do, that part of the state, there's a lot of comparisons to Illinois. We're relatively inexpensive for housing costs.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at some of the information out of the 2019, the 25th anniversary edition of the Kids Count Data Book. On the subject of education, where do we seem to stand on that here across the state and here in Northwest Indiana?
Actually, education is our bright spot as far as the state goes. That overall child well-being in Indiana, we're ranked 28th in the country. For education, we're actually ranked 14th. And so what we're seeing and what are, one of the biggest factors there is our 4th and 8th graders and their standardized tests in math and reading compared to their peers nationally. In your area, one of the really great pieces of news coming out of the data book is the fact that the number of high-quality early childhood care and education programs more than doubled in the last 3 years. So that's not to say that it's meeting all the needs that are out there, but again, there's been significant progress.
And Tammy Silverman says that all of the Northwest Indiana data from the latest Kids Count book is available right now on the website, IYI.org. And Tammy will be back with us on Regionally Speaking on Wednesday to talk about child abuse and child neglect prevention. Time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts. And here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
This is Tricia Hernandez, Development Director for South Shore Arts and the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, though today we're talking about South Shore Arts.
We are. Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Yes, we have our big event coming up every year, and this year it's our 26th annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
Mm-hmm.
It's June 7th, always the first Friday in June. It's our event that we raise money for our education programming, our Every Kid program in the community. So we're really excited about this year's theme. It is Rocket Man. And so we're going to have a little celebration of the moon landing, a little tribute to Elton John with his biopic coming out in May, and just a lot of fun. As our board members say, it'll be a blast.
Yeah, lots and a great graphics designed for the event by our board member Judith Mayer of Judith Mayer Creative.
Yes.
She always does a great job. We all select the theme.
Right.
It was a lot easier this year than it was last year.
It came really quickly.
You would think the 25th annual would be super easy something to do. You know, oh, we can do the 25th, this or that. Oh, no. It was just an arduous task.
It was an arduous task. But this year is cool. So I think our invites are or invitations are going out today, actually. And so people will be receiving them. But don't let that stop you. If you don't get an invite, just call. We can't possibly know everybody that wants to come or has just heard about the ball. This year, a little different. We're talking about dress to impress. It's usually a black tie event. This year, it is black tie optional. So I think that will give people a reason to even come last minute if they want.
Sure. You have to wear something.
You do.
But you have to dress to impress.
You have to dress to impress. So, and I mean, we want to reiterate that there are so many ways that you can contribute to the ball, and any donation, monetary or auction-wise or having a table, all of that is really, really appreciated. I don't care if it's $25. We'll have our website set up that you can actually go to it, and then go to your donation if you'd like to make one. We also have a website that we're going to be using for all of our auction items, and anybody can bid on those.
Mm-hmm.
Remember last year, we were just amazed at people from around the state were bidding on some of our things.
We already had, what, $13,000 in bids before the event?
Before the
event. Even started. And it's $175 to attend.
$175 per person.
But you don't have to attend in order to participate in the auction or, as you said, to donate. donate.
To donate.
The benefit the proceeds of the ball go to the Every Kid program that Trish mentioned, which is all of the arts education programs that we provide in schools and at social service agencies or in municipal parks largely for free.
Right.
To the people who receive the services. They don't have to pay a thing. And those programs serve anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 kids a year. So it's really important, that work that we do in the community. And now we're starting our new Teen Arts Board under our education director, Micah Bornstein. He's putting that together. And even our annual Tri-County Junior Senior High School Art Show has a long name. Is a part of the Every Kid program.
Absolutely. And that's opening April 27th. We have an award ceremony on Sunday, May 5th. That's from 1 to 3. Everybody is invited to come. You will be blown away. It is art floor to ceiling. We usually have about 800 and some pieces of art in the gallery. And we have between 33 and 37 schools in our Tri-County area here that participate. So, and it is our 45th year, which is really cool.
It is. And it's one of the shows that people look forward to the most, I think. And we give away close to $10,000 in prizes and scholarship money that people have been donating, some of them for over 3 decades.
Absolutely.
Yeah, people love to give to this show. It's
they
a wonderful
do.
Thing.
And this show is endowed by many people, too, who have a certain prize that they want to carry on.
So there are lots of ways to support South Shore Arts and its youth serving arts education programs right now. Giving to the high school show would be one of them. But coming to the Beaux-Arts Ball or bidding on an auction item is a really fun way to do it. You can be in your jammies.
And
you can support the arts in your jammies. And we're saying, to go along with our Rocket Man theme and the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, it's one small step. What is our slogan?
Right. It's one small step for you, one giant leap for the arts.
I like that.
We like
that. Okay, thanks, Trish, for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online right now at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday at this time on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. That's it for this edition of Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.